We were back East Indiana with the Orm family. Frontiers, which is the mission agency that sent Ed and Sue out, will be keeping their account open for at least 90 more days, 3 months. And they may extend it to 6 months. There's a good chance they'll extend it to 6 months. Now, how that works is if you make a donation to Frontiers and designate it for Ed and Sue Orm, then Sue will get the money minus the small overhead. It's the way it's always been. So that's probably the best way to get resources to her directly and personally, and you will get a tax receipt. So that will be held open for 6 months, and yeah, our church is setting up a fund, kind of an educational fund for the children through the memorial fund. So that's in place. Some of you were wondering whether Ed had life insurance. Frontiers carried a very small policy on him. I think it was what?
It was
$10,000.
And a lot of it was eaten up with the costs of bringing his body back. And some of you may not know, but in Pakistan, the typical death scenario is that they bury the body within 24 hours. You probably already heard all that. Or they cremate immediately. So Sue had to go through quite a bit of difficulty just to find an embalmer and preserve Ed's body. And it was very, very costly to bring his body back to the States. But all those costs were covered by Frontiers. It was really difficult. She had to pack up their belongings and close up their home and attempt to sell the car. But not all of that actually happened before she left. So thank God there are people back in Karachi. You know, as difficult as it is to set up a business and do all the paperwork over there that Ed and Sue had to go through to set up their presence there and their business, it's even more difficult to close it out. To close out a bank account, to close out a business account, to seal up, you know, business documents. It's a nightmare of red tape. So I'm glad that there are people helping Sue. Pray that she won't carry that weight. You know, there are other people who are there. They're helping with those details. It may take months to unravel. And even to sell a car there is a big deal. And it couldn't be done in the time she had. It was really just so, so delightful and precious that the family, the Pakistani family, Eunice and Dolly Coker are their names. They were the first people with whom Ed and Sue and the boys ate a meal when they arrived in Pakistan in 1989. And they're the last people that they ate a meal with in Karachi. And Eunice and Dolly have flown. This is Pakistani hospitality. They said, "You delivered this precious family into our hands. We have brought them back to you." And they've left their ministry and their everything in Karachi, and they are here with Sue. They traveled with her and the boys, and they are staying with her until she doesn't need them anymore. That was such a blessing. Such a blessing. They are delightful people. They have a powerful gospel ministry. In fact, there's a price on Eunice's head because he's a Muslim convert who is very, very successful in reaching the imams and the leaders of the Muslim faith in and around, well, actually in many parts of Asia, but certainly in Pakistan. He was such a blessing and an encouragement to all of us while we were there. And his wife, Dolly, just a delightful woman. Very helpful for Sue right now because Sue is still in a transition between the Eastern world and the Western world. And it was really difficult for her last weekend because she was surrounded with people, and that was a good thing. But that was also the very Eastern thing, to have all the people around and just there and there. And the Western part of her was needing a little more time alone. And so we were able to work at, thank God for some really sensitive people who were part of the group. And one of the gals, well, the contingent from our church was really all of you packed in a bag with Hugh and me. And I just made sure that we really conveyed that. And Sue realized that Hugh and I were there for ourselves personally, but also as representatives for this class who has supported them and loved them and continues to do so. And I brought that pack. I had this nice packet of cards and things that you had written and sent along to Sue. It almost didn't make it. In fact, it took an interesting trip to Washington, D.C. in my luggage. Yes, I arrived late Friday night. The memorial service was early Saturday morning, and thank God we were traveling with Dick and Dottie again. The last time we traveled with Dick and Dottie was in Africa, and I wore Dottie's clothes for 5 days in Africa while my trip circled my luggage circled the globe a couple of times. This time, we looked at each other this time and said, "What is it? You know, what is it when we travel together?" And she said, "I always bring an extra dress." So Saturday morning, for the memorial service, I was wearing Dottie Anderson's dress. Fortunately, it was a little long on her. And her feet, though, she's a size 6, and I'm a 7.5. So that was a little uncomfortable. But by the afternoon, I had that, after everything was over, I had that packet, I had my luggage back, and when I didn't need it. But the important thing is, I delivered that packet from you folks. So it did indeed arrive. She just was so grateful for that. And at any rate, we had Pastor Dick and Dottie. We had Jim Zilinga, the Rich and Mary Sue Robeson, the Bessies, Tom and Janet. What's the name? Mike and Janice Vessie were there. Jenny Armstrong was there. Did I say Rich and Mary Sue? Mary Joe? Yeah, I did. And Mary Upham was there. Trying to think. There were probably some others. But
total of 50.
And then, of course, David and Sonova Mitchell were there. Mitchells come to our class sometimes. They're the ones that Ed and Sue formed a friendship with before they went to the field, while they were on the field. And David and Sonova stayed all week, I believe, with them. They're so sensitive to to Sue and to her difficulty right now. It was great to have them there. And the nice thing is, too, that Snovy's a nurse. And she recognized quickly that, number one, Sue wasn't getting enough time to be quiet and to be away from the crowd. But secondly, that Sue was not getting adequate sleep, not by a long shot. And the two younger boys were a little bit sick. Peter had a cold and was coughing, and Josh was developing a little stomach flu or something. It's often the case when kids make a huge trip and suffer an emotional loss. You can imagine their immune system is really down. So the kids were sick, and Sue was staying up with them and, of course, was having trouble sleeping anyway. And so Sonova intervened and said, "Look, Mary Jo is here. She can be on the couch and listen for the kids. You will take some melatonin, and you will sleep. This is your nurse speaking, not your friend. I'm here as your friend, but right now I'm your nurse. And your nurse says, you have to do this." So Sue relented and took the melatonin, and on, I guess it was last Sunday night, she got about 7 hours of sleep, which was the most she's had in a long time. So that really helped. But I asked Sonovi as we left on Monday, I said, "Can you keep this up?" She goes, "Yes, it will happen every night, you know, while I'm here." And she'll make sure that Sue starts to get some adequate sleep, because she was really, the strain was just taking a huge toll. But let me tell you, the hard part, and I'm really glad things began with the graveside service. It's the reverse of what we've experienced in the past. Usually we have the big memorial service at the church or wherever, and then the graveside service. This one was the other way around. And in one sense, it was really good, because that was so traumatic. Just being there with this little Pakistani coffin and having to place it in the ground, it was just, because we were all still grappling with the reality of the loss. And for Sue, it was her moment to finally be surrounded with her loved ones and friends. And here's, you know, it was a horrible time. To be honest, it was just horrible. And yet, of course, the Word of God was there and the Spirit of God was there giving grace. So we got through that part. So we got the really, that was so traumatic. But then we made it short. Dick read some scripture, and we gathered around, and just, and then he escorted Sue and the boys to the car and just said, look, everybody who wants to talk, just talk, you know, later, after the service. There'll be a big luncheon. We'll all be together. So we went from the graveside to the church, and Pastor Dick officiated at the service, and he very sensitively realized that people had come from literally all over the world to be there. The church was packed to overflowing. There were people from England. There were people from the Philippines. There were, of course, the people from Pakistan. And then there was this contingent from California. There were people from Florida. There were people from different places along the East Coast and all across the U.S. The place was packed, and all of us were there with hearts just breaking and overflowing with, you know, shock and grief. And Pastor Dick got up and said, you know, he opened the service. And then he said, I realize there are many of you here who have things you really, are, you know, God has laid on your heart to share just with Sue and the boys. And he said, I had these first two pews here just roped off. And he said, I want you just to expedite things. I want you to come forward now and sit here. And then one by one, just take your turn at the microphone and return. Well, within moments, those first two pews filled up, and he just stepped back. He stepped to the back of the platform, and one by one, these men and a few women got up. One who got up to speak was Sally Livingston, Greg Livingston's wife, and of course, he's the head of Frontiers, the mission. But we got to hear from people who've known Ed from the time he was 4 years old. And it was such a blessing to hear all these personal stories and all the ways that Ed had touched their lives. And there was laughter and there were tears and lots of tears, but it was so fun to just get this look. And for the boys, this was all captured on tape, on videotape, I believe, possibly on audio. But the boys got to hear stories of their dad and to meet people that their dad had known and loved. And so many of them directed comments right to Sue and the boys. And several, especially a couple of the men and the women, really gave attention to the teamwork that Ed and Sue represented on the field. That all that Ed accomplished, which was wondrous, really, it was a testimony to God and his power. But they acknowledged the fact that Sue was an integral part of that process, and just, it was really, really wonderful. And then, so just one by one, Hugh got up, and all the different ones, and then, so there was, this thing went on. But you know, it was so satisfying. How many times have you been to a memorial service for someone, and it was over so fast, and you just walked out, and you just felt, I don't know, like shortcut somehow. And this was the one time in my life when I felt like there was a satisfactory kind of closure. People got to say what needed to be said, and there was no sense of rush at all. It was very slow, and there was some wonderful music. And then in the end, to my amazement, Sue stood up and walked to the microphone and thanked everyone for coming, made some comments, even made people laugh about, you know, the fact that it sounds as if it's feels as if Ed was just such a wonderful person. You can't think of anything weak or bad or whatever. And she said, you know, and I'm married to him, and I can't think of anything, you know, that I would change or whatever. And then she said, but his mom is here, and I did hear a few things. You know, so it was wonderful. God gave her the strength to do this, to get up and say words and just let us know that she's dealing with this and that God's dealing with her and helping her, and he will continue to be her strength. And I'll tell you, that was an incredible time. And then we all gathered a huge group. The church and friends provided for a wonderful big luncheon there. Hugh and I got to meet many people and just find out all the links that Ed had made for us that we didn't even know about, and all the mutual friends we had all over the place. And one of the fun things was for Hugh was to discover that the... Do you remember a few weeks ago when he was in Indiana and he spoke at a church in Zionsville? The pastor of that church is the pastor who did the marriage ceremony for Ed and Sue. And we didn't know that. We did not know. And Ed was the one who started, on his last trip here, he started, they were college roommates. He started talking to that pastor, you've got to get Hugh to come to your church. You've got to get Hugh to come to your church. So the pastor said, yes. It took me 12 months to work out all the details to have Hugh Ross come to my church. And Ed Orme dies, and he's here in one day. That's interesting, he said. That's really interesting. But it was also just one of those other, you know, bonds that that God built for us. Let's see. There were probably some other things I wanted to share. I don't want to take the whole class time, but in the time... Oh, go ahead.
Her family, we heard some of her family was real excited about her going to Mission Field.
No, Sue is not real... She doesn't have a real close relationship with her mom and dad, and she has... Her parents, who live in Florida, and she has two brothers and a sister. And they're interesting people. They're sweet people. They had come from a Church of Christ background, which is a very... the particular part of the Church of Christ really acknowledges that only people in their church are Christians, and people outside are not. So it was a long time coming before her family even accepted the fact that, you know, that Ed and his family were Christians, and that it's difficult. It's one of those weird, sticky doctrinal things. I don't think they're still there, you know, believing that Ed and Sue aren't Christians. I think it's quite different now, but that's a lot of alienation that took place. She doesn't have, but she was doing her best while we were there, in fact, to even spend some time with her mom and dad and try to establish some relationship with them. She's been building a relationship with her sister, who is a really recent Christian, a young-born Christian. So they are beginning to build a relationship. And doesn't she live there in Indiana
there,
now?
Right.
And her two brothers we met, and they're nice guys, but it's like, hello, are you there? They're just very unexpected. Non-expressive. You can't, you know, I couldn't tell much from them. And Sue just said, that's just the way they are. They don't express, and we've not been close. So at any rate, so that's kind of the situation with her family. But it was really wonderful for us that in the evening, after we all sort of rested in the afternoon and gave Sue and the boys a chance to have some downtime, and then Saturday evening, the whole SMCC contingent and a couple of other close friends gathered at the... we were all staying at the OMS headquarters. It's this wonderful mission compound there in Indianapolis. This big piece of land, and on this piece of land are these, like, apartment units, apartment buildings. And some of them, the one that Sue and the boys are in, even has a little kitchen and dining room and living room and a couple of bedrooms and a bath. Hugh and I were in one that was a little more like a motel unit, you know. But and it was very nice. We were surrounded by this big lawn, and there was a play area for the boys where they could, you know, shoot a few baskets and play a little cricket. They had their cricket bats with them. In Pakistan, that's the sport, you know. And in fact, that was one of the difficulties, is that Ed was the cricket coach for his son David and David's team. So the team lost the coach as well as, well, anyway. So we were all staying together, and Saturday evening we all gathered at Sue's request over in the unit where she's staying. In fact, the OMS allowed us to use whatever we needed. They even opened up two units that evening so we could kind of spill over and have enough room to be. But we just sat with Sue, and we prayed with her, and we sang, and we listened. Mainly we listened. We asked her to recount for us just what had occurred and what it was like for her. And it was gut-wrenching just to hear. It was a difficult death. And you know, we didn't realize. I looked up some things to find out a little bit about cerebral malaria and what it is and what it does. And I guess about a month before Ed's death, he had been out in the rural area where he always went to minister among the Baluch people and the Barawi. He was actually making inroads to another people group through the Baluch. There are actually three cultural groups that are fairly closely intertwined there. And Ed was one of the first to find ways to build bridges among the three and to spread the gospel among all three groups. So some magnificent things were happening, and by God's grace will continue to happen as a result of his labor there. But he had been out in the country, and that's probably where he got a mosquito bite from one of these infected mosquitoes. Malaria is a parasite, but there's one mutation. Is it like a
malaria C?
It's a mutant of this parasite that's deadly, and it's very rare, but he got it. And the sad part is you don't know you have it. So he started to feel just not himself, not feeling his usual energy. And then after a couple of weeks, he started to look jaundiced. He was looking very yellow, and people were worried that he had contracted hepatitis. And he kind of ignored his symptoms because he was giving the Sunday morning message at the International Congregation, the International Fellowship there in Karachi, the Sunday before he died. So he was working assiduously to get his message ready for that. And he had some very important documents he was pulling together to propose, actually, a strategy for reaching the Baluch, the Barawi, and this other people group. It starts with an S, and forgive me, I can't pronounce it. But anyway, he was working on that. So he was working late, and he wasn't feeling well, and Sue kept saying, "Are you sure you're okay?" He says, "I don't know, I guess maybe I'm getting the flu," and everybody's going, "Ed, you're yellow, you need to go." So he finally went, he did his sermon, and then Monday he went to the hospital and was tested for hepatitis, and they sent him home. And at home, he just began to feel worse and worse. In fact, even on that Sunday, the day he gave his sermon, his renal system began to fail. His urinary tract was not working correctly. And then, you know, with this other thing, that's why he finally relented and went to the hospital and allowed himself to be tested. But they did think that was very strange. The hepatitis wouldn't necessarily have brought about that other system. Well, then he just began to feel worse and worse and worse. And then he couldn't breathe. His lungs were... He couldn't breathe. And so it was very confusing for Sue. She knew that he was ill. She didn't know what he had. He had had asthma in the past. So when he had trouble breathing, she thought, oh, all the other stress and everything has brought on an asthma attack. So they tried to, you know, respond to the asthma, but it wasn't asthma. It was this malaria parasite that was literally what it does is destroy your internal organs. All your internal organs fail. And, so she realized this was really getting to be catastrophic, and they rushed him back to the hospital, the same hospital that had released him a few hours earlier. They recognized they were dealing with something very serious. They treated him as best they could, but then they couldn't do what they needed to do. And at that point, they still weren't absolutely certain what was going on. They did transfer him to another hospital in the middle of the night, and... of course, there is no treatment for this. It is a deadly thing. It is a deadly and rare ailment, but that was it. They transferred him, and nothing could happen. And Sue, of course, is really just... At first, she said she was tormented by the thought that if I had just recognized sooner what was happening, if I could have just, you know... And then, of course, it was really heart-wrenching that, you know... He was just failing so fast right before her eyes, and he was looking so weak and calling out. So it was really hard, but Sue had a chance to share with us the details of what she went through and just to pour it out for us. I'm sure we don't know all the details, but I think it was maybe part of the healing process for her to be able to describe all of this, because we didn't want her to have to tell this story over and over again to many people, and I trust that you will keep it in confidence and keep it in your hearts as a way to pray for her. Know that she's, I tell you only because I want you to know the severity of the trauma that this woman has suffered, and to be really sensitive to that. And that's why I was really concerned at first. They were talking about this celebration service for the homegoing of Ed, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, we do in our hearts celebrate for Ed. He's free, he's home, he's well, he's fine, and he knows from his perspective how all this is going to play out and how faithful God is going to be to his family, to his boys, to his wife, and to fulfill the mission that he began. Yes, we celebrate that, but for the rest of us right now, this is we want to honor him, but it is still, you know, just ripping. It is so sad. And some of you and I have been sad all week. It's just really difficult. So I was glad that some people were sensitive to that and sort of toned down some of that typical kind of wanting to encourage response. Anyway, so we had our time with Sue Saturday night, and then several people had to leave Sunday morning, but a few of us were able to gather. Some of us who were still there on Sunday morning gathered and in the same place again, back at Sue's apartment there, and had a worship service, a worship time on Sunday morning together. It was really, really precious. And then we all went out to lunch together, and we invaded a Denny's and about drove him crazy, I think. We had the men, we did it real Pakistani too. All the men were sitting at one table and all the women were at another table. And I was really blessed to meet one of the people who had come to be by Sue's side there in Indiana for this week. I believe she stayed the whole week. Her name is Margaret Gribben, a very wonderful British woman, a dear friend that Ed and Sue, that her children, actually her son and daughter-in-law, had come to the field to spend some time in Karachi, and they were just wonderful. I remember getting the emails about how great it was to have Joff and Claire on the field with them. They were a wonderful team, wonderful teammates for Ed and Sue during the short time they were there. Joff and Claire had to go back to England. They had twins, and they've had a number of things go on in their lives, but they're back in England. Ed and Sue got to visit with them this summer, and they stayed in the home of Margaret, Joff's mom, who happens to be a therapist, a counselor, a trained and licensed and wonderful Christian, sensitive counselor person. And so she flew to be with Sue. Sue asked her to come, and she was there. And she was a wonderful ministering angel to Sue during this week, I'm sure. She was during the weekend, and to all of us. She was just a delightful human being, and I kept thinking, wow, God, you're just so amazing, the people that you bring and the way you minister to every one of the needs. So Margaret was there, but see, now this is my message to you. Most of these people are now, as of today, going back to their homes. Eunice and Dolly are still there. She doesn't need long letters or long phone calls, but if God just gives you the little nudge, if you could drop her just a little card this week or next week or sometime in the next little while, if you write her a letter, she's going to feel obligated to answer you. So as much as you might like to do that, don't. If you could just say, I'm thinking of you, I'm praying for you, or, you know, I hope, whatever, say whatever, but make it short. And just, she needs to hear from people. Yes? I have the address for the OMS international place, which you could say, you know, Sue Orme, care of OMS International. And that's Post Office Box A, if you want to write this down. P.O. Box A. On those letters, did everybody catch the letters? It's O. M as in manna and S as in society. Okay, OMS International, Post Office Box A, Greenwood, Indiana. And the zip code is 46142. So that's my You want to write it on the board? Okay, it's that one right there. Anybody else have any questions that you want to ask about any of it or about anything? Yes. Against this particular strain of malaria, there is no, at this current time, there is no protection. Yes. A matter for personal prayer. Sue is torn about where to be, where to settle with her boys. She's torn between knowing that her family's in Florida and they don't have a particularly close relationship with her family. They do have relatives, his relatives and her sister, there in Indiana, in the Indianapolis area, and the cost of living there is reasonable compared to California. So she has relatives there in a economically feasible sort of setting, but then her support base, Sue's closest friends, and where she feels like her church family lives, that's right here. But she's thinking there's no way she can afford to live in Southern California with her four boys. So, and then I think she's worried about whether or not it would be bad for the boys to be so far away from any relatives. So she's torn, and she's really, and you know, I just try to say that you can't make your decision this week. Maybe not even next week. So maybe not even the week after. But give yourself time. And then I did ask her to leave her options completely open and not to close off the possibility that God might be able to provide for her if this is the place that is best for her and for the boys to live. And if he will provide surrogate grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins for these kids out here, he can certainly do that. And he can certainly provide financially for her to live out here. And she said, well, yeah, but you're talking about San Dimas and out that way. And she goes, I really need to be close to the church. You know, and I thought, well, you know, there's always Monrovia and, you know, parks and... We just talked a little bit about it, just for a few minutes, and I said, just leave the door open, okay? Just leave it open. And I invited her to come and visit us. I said, you know, we have a big house and no furniture. It's a great place for you and the boys to hang out. Just put sleeping bags on the floor, you know, and we'll all be together and it'll be okay. And she said, well, we'll talk about it later. And I said, absolutely. So we are looking forward to the fact that Tom and Jeanette have said that they will be able to go back and visit Sue and the boys possibly in the near future. We don't know when yet, but I think that would be tremendous. And if we can give you some help to go, I think the class wants to think about sending you on our behalf, but... It'd be, she loves you, and just thank you for all your prayers. And she did ask us, thank Paradox's class for their support, their love, their prayers. She's going to need them ongoing. So thanks for letting me talk.
Thanks, Kathy. Yeah, and OMS International is going to permit her to stay at the compound for an indefinite period. So she's under no pressure to find a home, but that's one of her requests. She says, you know, I really don't know where home is. And I need to find where our home is. Well, yeah, we found out their computer was really obsolete for making things work here in the States, but we were able to get her a computer just before we got on the plane. So that is taken care of, so they can communicate. Yes.
That's why we bought her a system. We went out to Best Buy to see if we could just get her a monitor, and then but we took Stephen with us. He's 16, you know, and very computer savvy, and he let us know in his own quiet way that the old hard drive was pretty rinky-dink and was not adequate for even the stuff, even some of the notes. What they did was to bring the guts of their computer with them, and they had floppies with a lot of Ed's documentation, you know, recorded on those floppies. And he said, by the time we get... Anyway, he let us know that the best thing... He never asked for this, but it became clear from what he said that they really needed a new system. So So we were able to get a wonderful bargain right just down the street from this OMS place. There was a Best Buy, and they had a wonderful, you know, package deal and a whole system, a really nice, what is it, a 750 megahertz system with
yeah,
a monitor.
Yeah, it was very nice at a very good price.
Okay.
And
we set them
so
up.
So they're all set up.
And part of the deal was a deal to connect them to email and internet access and all that. They have to get that installed. We will be getting a new email address for them. So remind me, okay, in the weeks ahead, that because Stephen was going to try to get all that set up this week, and then they will be able to start emailing people again, and that'll be helpful. He'll probably be the computer guy for the family. But anyway, we actually asked her to keep the old system because for just $120,
yeah,
she can get a new monitor and actually use that old system as a backup, maybe for the younger guys to do some stuff.
But right now, she's not too keen about having two computers.
Yeah, she's afraid so they'll use it to play games all the time.
So yeah, she's
right.
Yeah. And, you know, what Kathy said, that, you know, kind of the breakthrough that Ed pulled off on the mission field was to form links with these three people groups. And what I heard from a missionary is that was the first one to bring believers into these three different groups together to work on a larger strategy. And one of the things they're thinking about, and there's a good chance this will come to fruition, is there's a new technology institute being developed with Christian Resources in Karachi. And they would like to name that after Ed, and use that as a vehicle to try to continue this breakthrough into these three different groups where they can get them working together and reaching out to a larger context. So, you know, we're all wondering, you know, what's God got behind his death? Whenever, you know, a saint like that dies on the field, there's a purpose. And we're all still wondering what that purpose is, that, you know, life always springs from death. As we talked about here, so we're just still trying to feel our way through that. But it's fun just to see, or encouraging, I should say, just to see that that kind of passing of the baton is already in process. To what degree it's will multiply, we don't know. So, but it also was significant for me just to realize how God connects his people. I mean, I was amazed how many people I knew there. And I had no idea they knew Ed. They had no idea I knew Ed. And it was like that for a lot of us. And, you know, we don't realize how God's Holy Spirit works through God's people to bring about, you know, a common missionary thrust. But it was wonderful for a lot of us to get to see that firsthand. So, anyways, appreciate your prayers that went with us. And also appreciate your prayers for Ed and the four boys in the future. Sue, and the four boys, yes. Well, the two younger boys, and well, I mean, that when we arrived there was a lot of concern. You know, Sue seemed to be doing okay, but the four boys seemed to be struggling, and particularly one was kind of hiding it. That would be the older boy, Stephen. And then the one next to him, who's, what, 13, he was the one that was really going through the emotional trauma. But we saw, I mean, we were there 2.5 days, and we saw the four boys really starting to come together in a way that we hadn't seen at the beginning.
One of the good things is that a family that had been their pastor and their pastoral family there in the International Church in Karachi, those people have since taken a ministry position down in San Diego, and they have boys. They have kids, actually, two girls and a boy, that the Orm kids were close with over on the field, and they came and brought their kids. So that really helped. We saw the boys interacting with the kids, and they had someone their own age. And I also found out, even before Sue did, actually, that Dolly Coker, the Pakistani lady, was observant of the fact that Sue was afraid that he was just totally blocking out all his grief, and that she hadn't seen him cry. She hadn't seen him express himself. What she was unaware of was that she wasn't with him for several hours when she was taking care of arrangements and things, and he went over to his best friend's house, and I guess just really just poured his heart out and just sobbed and did what a boy would do who was attached to his dad. And then he came out. They said he went in the back room for a while just to be by himself. And when he came out, he wiped his face and he said, "Now I got to be strong for my younger brothers and my mom." And you know what? We saw him being strong for his younger brothers and his mom. And I think Dolly was going to share that with Sue that, like, Sunday or Monday sometime, so that Sue wouldn't worry about Stephen not having had a chance to express his grief. So that really comforted my heart. I was concerned, but he seemed fine, actually, to me, and I thought, something's going on here. He's doing okay. And anyway.
Yeah,
so
I just sensed that that service, it went for 2.5 hours, and I just saw it really ministering to the four boys.
The little guys, they're going to have trouble.
Right. But they got to hear things, and you're wondering, why is God doing this? What's the purpose behind it all? But there was a lot revealed during those 2.5 hours where we could see, well, we don't understand everything, but there are some clear signs that God's using this for his good. So I think that's encouraging. And I was watching the boys, and they seemed to be really administered by that. Hey, we got a few minutes, so... this does take longer. And by the way, another member of our class was there. I'm amazed how many members of our class were there. Gary Miller flew up from the Philippines. I don't know how many of you remember Gary and Noel Miller. They're from our class ministering in the Philippines. But Gary flew out to be there. After all, he and Ed were best friends for many years. And they were the two who, before they got married, went to Southeast Asia to kind of scope things out, like spies on the field to see where they should be. And God put one in the Philippines and one in Pakistan. So, but it was really good just to spend some time with Gary. We talked about here, Tom mentioned that we're going to be showing this video next week. I'll be in Texas, the Midland, Texas area, next Sunday. But we've just got the videos from the John Ankerberg show of the debate I did with Kent Hovind. And it's done with 8 cameras. It's really high quality. So we're going to show you that next week. And when I gave that brief report in the debate, I just shared with you the similarities between day-age creationists and calendar-day creationists and the differences. And he told me to go home and type it all up, which I did immediately, to bring next Sunday. But it kept sitting there on a pile. Well, I finally brought them today, okay? Many weeks ago, you heard me say I was going to do this. But I did bring them with me today. 10 major similarities between calendar day and day-age creationists. And by the way, when you read this, realize this is a generalization. Not every day-age creationist would believe the way that I would, for example. They don't even on our staff. Likewise, with the calendar day people. And then the differences. But what I really try to do here is focus on the 10 most significant similarities and the 10 most significant differences as a way to kind of begin to build bridges and resolution. So... why don't I make these available? And I'd say bring these with you next week because it'll help you when you're watching the video. Because I was kind of my game plan in doing the debate was to focus on these similarities and differences. Well, as you'll see in the debate next week, I never really got a chance to do that. I kind of got started on point one and never got to points 2 through 10. But at least you'll know the kind of strategy I had going into the debate is, let's try to, bring some resolution, build some bridges here, and we can do that. In fact, my comment to John Ankerberg was, if all we do is establish where we agree and where we disagree, that's worth doing. Well, the debate didn't quite go that way. But anyway, I'll make these available. We can hand them out. With a class like this, I decided to bring 100 copies because I know how things happen in the class here. If you need 100 more, I'll bring those next time. So, the debate goes on for a little more than 2 hours. I think it's about 2.5 hours. So the plan is you'll see a significant portion of that next Sunday, and I'll be back the following Sundays. This is my last trip for the year, so I'll be around. At the beginning of the second Sunday, I will field any questions you've got about the segment that you've seen. So as you watch next Sunday, feel free to make a few the way it reasons to believe we're thinking about maybe this would be a good tool to show in churches in general. And I'd like to get your feedback on this. So as you watch this, I'd like to get some feedback from you as to, you know, what is the best way to use this to try to bring some resolution to this issue. But one of the things we're thinking about is there some way we could get churches to show this, either in classes or a special service. So just appreciate your feedback on that. Let me try to set things up here. We've got just a few minutes left. But we're in Genesis chapter 9. Those of you who have been with us for a while, so we're going through the Bible, looking up these passages. And incidentally, I got another handout ready for you. I don't have it here today, but it's at our office, and I'll bring copies next time I'm here. And what it is, it's a list of all the scriptures in the Bible that pertain to creation. And you're wondering where we're going in this class. What is Hugh going to do after we get through Genesis chapter 11? Well, there's a few more passages we can go to. But one of the things that's really been coming on my heart is the reason why Christians fight over creation and they fight over faith science issues is there's a real lack of systematic study of the Bible. And, you know, I've been alarmed just doing some surveys in the Christian community. You know, how many of you have systematically read through the entire Bible? And what I mean by that, I don't know if I'm asking for hands. I don't want to embarrass anybody here. But it's something that has been a bit of a surprise to me. That, yeah, there are Christians who've kind of made their way through the Bible, but they do it over a course of several years. And it's not systematic where they read Genesis and then they go to Exodus and Leviticus and keep going till they get to Revelation. And I've been really quite ignorant or naive, I guess, about the fact that there really aren't that many believers within the church, even amongst the leadership of the church, where they do that. And so I've been asking myself the question, why not? And also realizing, because, you know, Kathy's lived with me all these years and realized just how frustrated I get that relatively simple issues within the church don't get resolved. You know, people continue to fight and split and have conflicts over issues which should be, you know, quote, no-brainers. Now, let's just get through it and move on. And maybe the answer to that frustration is the fact that we haven't been spending enough time just encouraging God's people to systematically read through the Bible. And one of the questions I've been asking myself, because I was rather surprised that a fellow that I admire as being a much deeper Bible scholar than myself, now he admitted to a bunch of us he hasn't done this. I said, well, if he hasn't done this, maybe there are others that haven't done this too. But what I'm really getting down to is why doesn't it happen? Well, number one, I'm discovering there's a lot of people who are leaders in the church that feel a lot of guilt over the fact that they've not been systematically reading and studying through the Bible. They know they should, but they don't, and because they don't, they feel this guilt. And I don't think it's just leaders. A lot of people feel that. And so what is it that's stopping people from doing this? And you know, we had a chance to talk about this when we were back in Indiana, because Indiana is a place, yeah? I'm talking.
Obviously,
there's been time in
individual
passages. Oh, yeah. So there's this one leader I'm talking about. I won't mention any names, but you know, he's really deep in God's Word. But there's certain issues I'm persuaded don't get resolved until God's people systematically read through the entire text, cover to cover. And moreover, I've discovered if you don't read it through fast enough, you don't get the systematic sense. What I mean by systematic reading through the Bible is where you read it through in a studious fashion, rapidly enough, that by the time you're done, you've got the flow of what the entire book is saying on certain subjects. Whereas if you take 8 years to get through the Bible, by the time you get to year seven, you've forgotten what you read in year one, and it's not systematic anymore. You haven't got that put it all together kind of thing. So how do you read through where you can put it all together? Well, you know, just in talking to people, I realize we don't read through it fast enough. You know, we have these programs where we're going to read through the Bible in a year or read through the Bible in 2 years. Well, if you take 2 years to read through the Bible, by the time you get to Revelation, you already have forgotten what you read in the book of Leviticus and may not realize that what Leviticus is saying ties into a theme that you ran into in Jude, for example. That may not come across to you because you just took too long to do it. Also, when you take that period of time, you know what happens over 2 years? You're going to have a slot where you're really busy. And when you really get busy, what do? You say, well, you know, I really don't have time to read 6 chapters today or 3 chapters today. Tell you what, I really got to let it go today, and tomorrow I'm going to read 12 chapters. Well, tomorrow's got its own busy schedule, right? And so eventually, you, by the time you get to the end of the week, you got, well, gee, I got to read 50 chapters today. And this gets so daunting that you say, you know what, I think I'm going to start all over again. And it's amazing to me how many people tell me that story. Yeah, I get started. I go from Genesis to Exodus, Leviticus. I get all the way to Judges. And by the time they get to Judges, something happens in their schedule where they get stuck. And then a period of maybe 6 weeks goes by, and they say, well, it doesn't do any good to pick up where I left off. I'm not going to remember what I did. So I can go back to the beginning of Genesis. Well, that probably explains why Genesis is so well known by so many people. They keep starting over again. Or what they'll say is, you know, forget the Old Testament. I'm just going to systematically read through the New Testament. And actually, I notice American Christians are pretty good at that. They do systematically read through the New Testament. But you know, you lose so much when you read through the New Testament and you don't have that Old Testament context to understand what the New Testament is talking about. And so, yeah, somewhere you got to get through those books of Leviticus and Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. A lot of people tell me Ezekiel is where they get stuck. They get stuck there more than they do back in Leviticus, but you just got to keep reading. Well, let me just share this with you. I think if you take more than 6 months, you're taking too long. Now, by the way, this is for me personally. The main thing is you have to do it in a way that's fun. If it begins to be a guilt trip for you, you're not doing it the way that's best for you. And, you know, I've met people who can, you know, read 3.5 chapters every night, and they get through the entire Bible, and when they get to December 31st, they start all over again. That works for them. But I'm discovering it doesn't work for everybody. What personally works for me is to make a goal of getting through it in 3 months. 6 months is a bit... If I take 6 months, chances are I'm not going to pull it off. But if I take 3 months or less, I'll get through it. And you say, wow, you know, how do you do it in 3 months? Well, you read faster. And that's tip number two. Why do people struggle in systematic reading through the Bible? They try to accomplish too much. I'm going to read through the entire Bible, and I'm going to make notes on everything the Bible's got to say about family, marriage, divorce, finances, end times prophecy, attributes of God, salvation theology, creation issues, etc. Well, my whole point is, hey, if you're going to be reading through it in 3 months, that means you can read through it 4 times a year. You don't have to pick up everything the first time through. And maybe a better way to do it is just pick one theme. For example, I want to see what the Bible's got to say about brokenness in the family. That's all I'm going to look for, nothing else. And I'm going to read through fast enough where I just pick up those portions. Yes. Okay, you know, what translation do you use? Well, again, I'm just talking to you from my own personal perspective. I like those Bibles that have headings and subheadings. That kind of helps me see on the page what the content's all about.
Like
NIV? Well, I mean, all Bibles do that these days. But and there, well, I shouldn't say all Bibles, but every major translation will have a version where they kind of give you this broken down outline where you got headings and subheadings, etc. Whereas in the old days, you pick up a Bible and it was just dense type all the way down, unbroken dense type. And so if you've got a theme saying, I'm going to read through the Bible and pick up everything it's got to say about finances and economics, if you don't have an outline like that, it's going to be a little bit harder for you to pick off those passages. So that's what works well for me. Well, you might also want to target them. For example, if I want to read through the Bible and pick up all the humor in the Bible, I'll probably read it in the Living Bible, Living Translation. Because if I try to do that in the New American Standard Bible, it really strips all the humor out of it in the translation process. But I remember one time I read through the Bible and says, I want to pick up everything the Bible's got to say that will help me to minister to cultists. Well, I chose the New American Standard Bible because it's the most precise in pulling out the descriptions of who God is from the original and putting it in the English. Now, it's kind of a clumsy read, but given that that was my purpose, was to pick up these passages that would help me in ministering to cultists, I said, this is the one to go with. And Kathy can remember, before we were married, I did this, and what I did is I went through an NASB and underlined in red every passage that would help me minister to cultists. So, I would go around door to door, and that was my cult Bible. So when I ran into a cultist, I'd whip out my cult Bible, and it was all it was all underlined for me, ready to use. And after a while, I discovered I didn't even need that cult Bible. I had the verses memorized, so, kind of. And that's the kind of neat thing about systematic Bible reading, is after a while, if you use your systematic study often enough, you really know it. Or you know it better anyway. So it's a good idea to go out and buy a Bible just for your systematic reading. So to go out and buy a Bible and say, this time I'm going to pick up the stuff on creation theology. And I go through the Bible, outline the passages, underline the passages, make notes, whatever, but that's all I'm doing. Then I stick that Bible on the shelf, never have to go back to that, pull that Bible off. So these days people can afford to have more than one Bible. So, and sometimes that motivates me too. If I actually go out and buy a Bible to do a systematic reading, it motivates me because I got to justify that money I spent, right? Yeah, I'm Scott, so I figure, hey, if I spent that kind of money, then I got to keep going through this to justify that expense. So, whatever trick works for you. But it's interesting as we're going through this whole idea. By the way, I'm over time. I got to quit. Sorry about this. So did we get those things distributed? We did. Okay, next week we'll do that. By the way, what we're talking about in Genesis chapter 9, we're in that passage, middle of the chapter, we're talking about God's promise not to flood the earth again. But I want you to know as you go through that, to whom does he give the promise? Some interesting insights there as to whom he gives the promise. And because there have been big floods and what's going on there. But we'll look at that next time we come together. Thanks. We'll pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you that you've given us this book, the Bible. I want to thank you for how you use Ed and Sue Orem over there in Pakistan to assist in the translation and the distribution, particularly the distribution of those Bibles. Lord, I remember the story of how Ed would minister to beggars on the street by giving him a package with small gifts in it, but also God's Word. Lord, use your Word as your people multiply its distribution. And Father, I pray you would help your Word settle into our heart. Give us the means by which we can maintain our excitement and enthusiasm to study your word in a way that will help us to be transformed into the image of your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.